So let's get started with this new decision of Biden and his administration to not send more weapons to Israel. I think that was a huge change on their part. And how did you find this decision?
I think it was overdue, but I'm not totally convinced that it isn't anything but cosmetics. And the reason I say that is because there's plenty in the line, if you will, in the pipeline, or on the ground in the war reserve stockages and in Israel in general to do all that Netanyahu claims he wants to do in Rafah, that is, kill a lot of people. So the brouhaha over the U.S. cutting off weapons and such that Lindsey Graham and others have, called Hiroshima, Nagasaki. Well, this is terrible. This is terrible. Lindsey Graham ought to go crawl in a hole somewhere with the rats that he calls his brethren. And there are several others like him too. But I think it's mostly cosmetic. And what you're seeing about Graham and others who are hollering from their side of the aisle, so to speak, and Democrats even on the other side who are either hollering that it's still too much or not enough. It's all politics. It's positioning themselves for the presidential race to be sure, but really it's positioning themselves to win the Senate or lose it. That's the big issue in November. And it's looking increasingly like the Republicans are not only not going to win the Senate back, they're going to lose several seats. And that's got them really worried. And so then they let the attack dogs out and use Gaza and Ukraine as a thing to talk about and argue about and get ridiculously stupid about, like Lindsey Graham. But I really don't think it means a whole lot to those people dying in Gaza because there's plenty of ammunition left, as it were, to kill lots of people in Gaza. And I don't see a real relenting from that principal objective, which has been the objective all along. Going after Hamas, as I said in the beginning, going after Hamas is the strategic purpose that Netanyahu has set for himself, but really is a, there's a broader tapestry here, and it's continuing with a vengeance, everything Netanyahu has been doing for 15 plus years, eradicating Palestinians, dispossessing them of their property and their land, kicking them out of anything that looks like the West Bank, Golan, East Jerusalem, and now Gaza. And as many as he can get rid of in the process, that is to say, eradicate, ethnically cleanse, that's fine. And Gaza in October the 7th gave him the excuse to put it on steroids. So I don't see that we've stopped that, and it's now going to take its denouement, if you will, in Rafah. My big question is, what after that? It's been my question all along because I knew we were going to wind up at some point where Hamas still existed, would come back, would attack again someday, that Israel would not get Ben-Gvir all the territory that he wanted in Gaza so that he could make settlements everywhere. So where do we go with this kind of interim solution? And there are people postulating about that right now. One of them I saw today, I picked up this from, I don't know if you know about the Soufan group, Ali Soufan. Ali is a Lebanese American who probably, in my estimation, was the smartest FBI agent. And that's saying something because the FBI really has stepped on its own procedures since 9/11 and before 9/11. But Ali really was the guy who broke the case against the World Trade Center Al-Qaeda element and then did a lot to help with the Yemen attack on USS Cole, the warship that was struck by Al-Qaeda in Port Yemen, in Port Aden in Yemen. And Ali has a group now, and here's what he said today in his bottom line up front, he calls it. Various plans under discussion between the U.S. and regional officials for the governance of and security of post-war Gaza contain similar themes and principles. Major Arab states appear willing to contribute. Now, here's a key. But imagine Netanyahu accepting this now. Major Arab states appear willing to contribute personnel to an interim post-war security force and governing body, a clear pathway to an independent Palestinian state. is established if this happens. And this, of course, is what the Arab states want, particularly the ones in the lead. A key hurdle to developing a plan for post-war Gaza is Israel's resistance, tell me about it, on continued military access to the enclave and its resistance to a role for the West Bank-based Palestinian Authority. In other words, Israel wants to control Gaza. Other key questions include whether a post-war Gaza authority would be authorized by the United Nations, and here's a key too, whether U.S. troops would participate. That last element, if it is truly being discussed, is a first, and it was a no-no completely for the 40 years or so that I had anything to do with the government, and would make this have an entirely different complexion. The Arab troops would, of course, contribute a part of that change, but the major change would be if U.S. forces were involved. Now, I don't see, I like Ali, and I think he does a good job with this sort of thing, but I don't see this happening. I really don't. But that gives you some idea as to the length and breadth of what people are talking about now. And the desperation, really, in trying to keep Israel away from it. Or if it is there, it's there with a surrounding group of people who can keep it from doing other nasty things, which is contravening of Likud's right wing's purpose under Ben Gvir principally, which is to settle Gaza.
We know that after this decision of the Biden administration, Ben Gvir openly attacked on his Twitter attack Biden. He tweeted, "Hamas loves Biden."
Yeah. It's part of the political array in Israel too. It's not just in the United States that people are talking about this and using it to throw rocks at the other side, so to speak, but it's in Israel too.
The UN General Assembly has again suggested to the Security Council to consider a sovereign Palestinian state. And we had the reaction coming from the Israeli representative at the UN, just shredding UN Charter. And
he has to be, pardon my intervention here, but he has to be one of the most idiotic, unacceptable to the diplomatic corps in particular, individual I think I've ever witnessed at the UN. And I have seen some bad people at the UN representing different countries. But this guy is just, he's unconscionable. And just tearing up the UN Charter, what the hell? What kind of drama is that? I mean, what are you trying to suggest? Are you suggesting what other people are saying now? People who before were friendly to, even supportive of Israel, that they are beyond the pale? That's what a lot of people are saying now. That's not good for Israel. And this kind of drama at the United Nations or anywhere else for that matter, but certainly at the Security Council, is not good for Israel. You know, Bibi can stand up there and say, "I don't need anybody. Go away, everybody. I don't need anybody. I'll do it all myself." Well, we know that's political posturing. We know that's preposterous. He couldn't do it without the United States of America, sad to say. But for these diplomats to do these sorts of things in the settings that they do them in is just making my promise Israel will not be a state that more likely to come true.
This new decision on the part of the General Assembly at the UN, do you think that this time Security Council will consider it differently, or are they going to just reject it? The United
we'll
States?
We'll veto it. The United States will veto it. I'm not even sure we'll let it get there in terms of really being debated or voted on. But if it does get there and it is voted on, there's a sign. There's a sign that we couldn't stop it. And I'll cheer for that. I'll clap for that. But we'll veto it.
Do you think this decision on the part of the Biden administration was part of this pressure coming from students, from universities that are right now, they're forcing the Democratic Party, or they took into account other elements as well?
I'm going to be kind to Biden here. And it's my day to be kind to Joe Biden. I think there is a touch a taste, a hint of this is really not good, not politically, but the whole idea of genocide and the United States being wholly supportive of it. And that has to have penetrated the Jake Sullivan Blinken screen around him. It has to have penetrated. He's not a stupid man. He isn't. And so, I mean, he might be a little bit old and he might have trouble thinking nowadays. I wouldn't have any trouble with that. I'm pushing 80 and I'm having trouble. But I think that's part of it. And then the second part of it, you hinted at, he's a premier politician and a very, very close and passionate friend of Israel throughout his political life. So this is difficult for him. But the politics of it, as you just suggested, his being reelected, for example, foremost, are being affected. They're being affected in a way that not only threatens the prospect I was talking about before of winning Senate seats, but also threatens his being reelected as president. You may have seen that four key battleground states, Trump's leading in the polls now. I'm not sure that really matters in a real significant sense, because I don't think Trump is, I don't even think Trump is a viable candidate now with all the troubles he's got. But that said, you know, miracles do happen in reverse. And then the third thing I think is that Biden is worried about what he sees developing in the world. Xi Jinping's recent tour of Europe, if you will, the strategic way Xi Jinping did that, even going to Serbia at the 25th anniversary of our bombing of their embassy, which China has never forgiven us for. That's sort of to them like the hostage taking in Tehran is to us. They have John Bolton's too, you know, who never forget and never forgive. And Xi was, he's not one of those people, I don't think, but he certainly was using that to remind us of what we did. And the Chinese all believe that we did it on purpose. They think we did it on purpose. The idea that the CIA had old maps and didn't realize that that building had changed and was now the Chinese embassy, that's ridiculous to the Chinese. That, you know, we did it on purpose. So that and other things that are happening, I think Biden has to be realizing some of the things that you and I have been talking about and others have been talking about with you, that the world is changing. It's not a bipolar or a single pole world anymore. It's a multipolar world. China is a principal pole in that multipolar world, as we still are, but receding, and China's advancing. And this trip to Europe is proof positive of it, because he did some pretty neat things for China in Europe, which was to reinforce the idea that to Germany and to France and to others that, hey, and Viktor Orban and the visit in Hungary was sort of a refutation to these other people. You don't have to quit doing business with me. I'm the richest guy on the block. And you do not have to stop doing business with me. No, by the way, my buddy there in Moscow, he's ready to go. Oh, there's another Nord Stream pipeline. You know, you guys need to wake up. The world has changed. And if you want to be a part of that changed world, you better wake up and you better get this Ukraine crap behind you. You know, that was Xi's message, I'm sure, all across the place. And it's a very powerful message. And Biden, I think, at least in part, realizes that. We're losing, and all of our potential national security threats are winning. That's got to be disturbing to a sitting president.
You talk about Xi's visit to the EU. He visited France, Serbia, and Hungary. And how he managed that.
Let's go see Macron first and tell him, oh, I heard you might send your foreign legion in there. You probably shouldn't, because they'll all come home in body bags, you know.
Yeah, then he went to, I think the main visits went to Serbia and Hungary, because they have achieved some agreements. With France, that wasn't that much successful. How do you see this strategy of China and Russia on one side and the West on the other side?
That's an interesting question. I just spent about an hour and a half with a senator, And I was there with several other people, General Dennis Leitch and General Margaret Wilmoth, both of the reserves, who were having a tremendous problem in America recruiting. They're 35, 40% short. And so she's on the Senate Armed Services Committee, the senator. So we wanted to talk to her about that. But in the process of talking about the threat, she pushed back at us and told us she just made a tour of the Pacific and that she was convinced that we were isolating China, that with Vietnam, the Philippines, Korea, and Japan, formidably Taiwan, we were isolating China. And therefore, we were not to be worried too much about China. You know, I'm a Pacific hand. I'm an odd thing. I'm an anomaly in the United States Army. Never served in Europe. I served my entire time in the Pacific, Thailand, the Philippines, Korea, multiple times Korea, Japan, multiple times Japan. Traveled all over the region. I know how big that area is. We used to say we have 44 countries. We have 34 with ambassadors, that sort of thing. It's a huge AOR. To be a senator, to say that we're isolating China is just preposterous. I don't care, you know, I don't care if it's Japan and Korea, who are formidable allies. Vietnam, somewhat of a formidable ally, not at all scared of China in a visceral sense and able to stand up to her, doing so right now over the South China Sea rights, fishing and other things. But the idea that we have a senator and obviously the Senate of the United States of America that thinks that we are isolating China is really scary. It's frightening to a military professional like me. I wanted to say, if we sortied two carriers and the strike group that accompanies them into the South China Sea, which is China's Gulf of Mexico, you know, they don't have a Monroe Doctrine, but they do have the Dash 9 theory, which that Dash 9 line, which is nine dash line, which is sort of the boundary of the South China Sea that they claim is their Gulf of Mexico. It's as good as the Monroe Doctrine, certainly, probably more executable. We would lose those two carriers in the first 30 days with 10,000 Americans in the deep blue sea. If they were hostile, if they were going to do something to, say, defend some Philippine fishermen who were being accosted by the huge Chinese fishing fleet, which is five times bigger than our Navy, and every one of them armed to the teeth. These are, if you've ever seen them, put them on display. They put a third of their fleet on display at one point in the South China Sea and took pictures of it. It's massive. It looks like a picture from World War II in the Pacific when we had 7,000 ships under arms in the United States. So this is our Senate. This is our Senate. And, you know, I've said, we'd sail two carriers, maybe three would sortie, but not any more than that because we don't have that many to sortie. We only have 11 today, and five or six of them are stuck. They're stuck in maintenance overhaul and all this sort of stuff, and one of them is consigned to Japanese home waters by agreement. So three or four is about all we could send, and we'd be abandoning the Red Sea. We'd be abandoning the Persian Gulf. We'd be abandoning the Eastern Mediterranean in order to do this. And they'd be sailing to their death because we'd be in that isolated water of China that she's talking about, you know. We're smoking something, Nima. We have a whole body of people who are in charge ostensibly of this country and its national security. And I reminded both senators that we met that day, I reminded them that they have more authority and more responsibility for the armed forces of the United States than the executive branch under the Constitution. Article 1 is lots more for the Congress than the executive branch. And they're failing that responsibility. They don't understand what's happening. And you got two ways to look at this. Well, more than two, but two distinct ways you can look at it. We need to retrench. We need to cut back on our commitments. Largely, we need to cut back on the Levant, and we need to cut back on that region where we're spending so much money and so much time and so much military force. And we probably need to cut back on Europe even further than we did post-Cold War, although we made a pretty good retrenchment there. We could retrench all the way. This is not isolationism. This number one thing to do, retrenchment, is smart strategy. It's not stupid. It's not isolationism. We can do almost anything from the continental United States that we could do with all these 750 or so bases overseas. And we'd be a lot less threatening to our friends as well as our enemies. The second thing we could do is just go whole hog. Let's don't worry about $1 trillion interest payments on the debt. Let's don't worry. And that's real. That is real. That is coming to pass even as I speak, that we will have to pay our entire defense budget plus interest payments on our $35 trillion debt. This is staggering. But to hell with that. Run the printing presses, build up the massive force that you need, and then go out there and do what you need to do for a little while anyway, and then you'll be able to defend what it is you think you need to do. I'm really at a loss as to what we think we need to do other than, you know, protect Taiwan and what. I'm not even sure that that is an ironclad commitment, but that's what we say it is. And that's, China could take Taiwan in 24 hours, and we would be sitting there, thumbs, twiddling our thumbs and saying, do we want to risk nuclear war to take it back? Now, they won't do that. Xi Jinping will pick up the phone, he'll call Taipei, and he'll say, got a choice for you. And they'll say, we don't want that. Okay, we'll be your 54th colony or whatever the hell. You know, we'll do what Hong Kong did, but please let's negotiate a little better deal than Hong Kong got or whatever, because the Taiwanese are not that stupid. But here, I'm just going on and on, but my point is, we have no one in this country that understands the state of the union. It is not rock-bottomed and copper-riveted like Daniel Webster told the devil. It is anything but. It's got holes in the ship, its sails are tattered, the wind is blowing hard, and no one's at the helm. And that, for an 80-year-old man who spent 35 years, 40 years in the government, is really disheartening. Really disheartening. My nation doesn't know what it's doing.
There are two articles, one in Politico that says, too little, too late for Ukraine. This ammunition, this aid goes to Ukraine. And the other article in Wall Street Journal, they're saying that by early 2025, the war in Ukraine is over and Ukraine is defeated. And
wow, they're going to give them till 2025, huh?
In your opinion, when you look at the current situation in Ukraine right now, we've learned just today, we've learned that in Kharkov, the situation is so dire. Ukrainians are just leaving the city. How do you see the current situation of Ukrainian army?
I think it's really bad. And I really am concerned about what Putin is doing. Putting an economist in charge of his forces, I think, was a smart move. I wish we'd take a lesson from him. We've gone the other way. We've put now two in a row, almost, close enough together to matter, secretaries of defense in there, violating all of our previous strictures. They're former generals. And Austin, in particular, but Mattis before him, proved why we have those strictures. You know, the only civilian control of the military under our Constitution, which exists, is the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense, who share mutual responsibility for the armed forces, with the President being the key, but the Secretary being very... I'll give you an example of what I mean by it's very, very close sharing. The Secretary of Defense can deploy U.S. military forces across the globe on his own. He cannot execute. He cannot say, shoot. He can put them out there. He can send them out. Now, normally they don't. Normally they tell the president what they're doing through the National Security Council. But that's the authority. The president's the one who has to say, go kill people. Now, you got him out there, Mr. Secretary. Now you can kill people. But those are the two civilians overseeing our military, which our founders would have just applauded. Put a general in there. What have you got? I mean, here's a general who, unlike George Marshall, wasn't steeped in civilian politics and all the rest of the things that you have to be steeped in. Plus, George Marshall said, I never voted in my life and wouldn't vote because he thought, you know, you shouldn't vote if you were a military person. You should be absolutely apolitical. Now we're putting these people in here, and Austin is the worst of all so far, who just, what do you think Austin says to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or to the service chiefs? Of course you should have that. Of course you should have. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you should have that too. Oh, Israel wants this? Yes, send that over there. This is crazy. This is another example of how we are spoiling ourselves. We are defiling our own system. We're ignoring years, two centuries of practice and precedent in order to do things for basically political purposes. This is not good. This is not good. I think Putin doing what he did was a smart move. I think he's looking at the defense industrial base. He's looking at tying that base to what he might have to do in the future and making sure it doesn't go away again. It becomes even more robust and it has the right focus and the right strategy for what it's making and what it's going to make. And he needs an economist to do that. You don't need a general to run that. You need someone who knows what's going on in terms of managing something that big. We used to say our DOD was the largest not-for-profit enterprise on the face of the earth. Well, Russia's got one pretty much like that now, too, as does China. So you need a good manager, a good executive. You don't need a military officer. Now, the second thing is, I can't figure this out. He looks like he's making some fairly major moves up in the Northeast. Maybe even consolidating and going to launch an offensive down into Ukraine from that position. I wouldn't be doing that. I'd be down. Is this a feint? Is this to take their attention off Kherson and take their attention off the Black Sea coast? Because that's where I'd be going. I'd be concentrating on that. I'd be, as I've said many times before, I'd be after Odessa. I'm thinking future. I'm thinking war with the United States. I'm thinking, you know, China and Moscow allied, maybe with Iran, maybe North Korea, and taking on the United States, ultimately. Mearsheimer and others seem to think this is inevitable. It's just the reality of reality international theory that, you know, rising power, sinking power, they're going to fight. If that's the case, then I'd be lining up my ducks if I were Putin, not only by putting an economist in there to keep my industrial base going strong and build it out even further, but I'd be taking everything I could take in this present conflict so that I'd be positioned for one with the big guys. And Odessa just strikes me as, I'm a Navy guy. I spent, you know, 31 years in the Army, but I taught at the Naval War College, taught at the Marine Corps War College, wrote my master's thesis on attack submarines and support of the carrier battle group. I mean, what soldier ever did that before? I think the Navy is the most important defender of this country, frankly. That's what the founders thought, too. You know, they put in our Constitution to raise and support armies. They didn't say that about the Navy. They said provide for a Navy because they knew we were a commercial nation and they knew that our future lay in being a commercial nation. And navies protect commerce. And so the Navy is key, and we're murdering it. It was 33% short in its reserve component. It was 3,000, I think, short in its active component. And now they've got ships that they don't have enough people for, and we don't have very many ships. Putin's smart. He's smart. He's lining up his ducks for the future. And although I don't understand the northeastern concentration as opposed to one down south, I would understand it if it were a feint. Sort of like the move towards Kyiv in the beginning. The more I examine that, the more I think about it, the more I don't think it was the fiasco that everybody tried to paint it as, especially us and our media. I think it was just sort of a probe. it was a test to see what would happen. And what's happened since then has been not necessarily all positive for Russia, but it certainly has developed in a way that a big country would like it to develop if it were taking on a small country and wanted to do everything it possibly could to avoid escalation, but to win that conflict with the small country or to come out on top. And I think he's accomplished that. I think he's accomplished that. And I have a sneaking suspicion that a lot of this is Putin himself. I have a lot of, you know, I get a lot of enemies when I say I have admiration for him, but I can admire his mind without admiring his politics. And he just thinks a whole lot better than we do. There's no question about that. And he's cleaning up his act right now. I can just imagine what's going to happen within the next 24 months or so if he starts a full court press behind the scenes initially, of course, with supplying liquefied natural gas or whatever might come out of the pipelines to Europe again at a discounted price and ultimately weans them away from us, because that's the future. That's the real future. Clean fuel at a reasonable price, transitionable to no fossil fuels. That's the future. I think Xi also announced in Hungary that he was going to build two or three electric car factories. Holy mackerel, we're talking about tariffs on Chinese cars, sanctions on them. You know, here Hungary's going to have two. Hey, you're going to sanction Orbán in Hungary too when they produce them in Hungary? This is like Toyota coming to North America and expanding and having tremendously good automobiles built by Americans on American lines, but with Japanese technology and Japanese management. That's why they succeeded so well, because they built terrific cars in their competition's backyard. Well, that's what's going to happen now in Europe. And this is not going to last, this attempt, last-ditch attempt by America to reestablish its economic hegemony over Europe. That's part of what Ukraine is all about. It's not going to work. China's smarter than we are. Russia's smarter than we are, right now anyway. And by God, I don't see any talent coming down the road looking at the White House. They're winning. They've been winning for some time.
We've heard that Germany is buying 3 HIMARS, and Denmark is suggesting F-16s to be released within a month, and a lot of talks about sending aid to Ukraine. Without having an army in Ukraine, how do they want to continue this fight, in your opinion?
I think this is all high-toned rhetoric by the current political structures in these countries. And as I've said before, I don't think these political structures are going to adhere. I think they're going to go down. You have to look at the series of elections that will take place over the next 2 to 3 years. And in some countries, of course, you have the potential for an election tomorrow morning, depending on whether they have parliamentary systems or whether they have democracies that are more or less like our own. But I think these governments' time is limited. You look at the polls aren't good for any of them. They're not as bad as Japan or Germany or France. I mean, they're rock bottom polls there. And somewhat troubling, there are some alliances developing between the Alternative for Germany and Le Pen's party in France, for example, and the party in Italy that's now in power. Those are not necessarily poisonous or dangerous, but they could be. It just depends on how they develop. You know, you have this phenomenon in politics, democratic politics, especially liberal democratic politics, even. You have this thing where you have these people who come into office and they look pretty bad, and they look Nazi-like even, and they look like, 1933 Germany or whatever, the Weimar Republic. But all of a sudden, they get a taste of politics, and they get a taste of power and a taste of success, and they mellow. And then they become more or less just routine parties. Maybe they have a few wild people in them, but they become routine parties because basically democracy tempers them. And it sort of attenuates the radicalism. And if you're going to stay in power, the danger there, of course, is a Hitler or someone like that, who monopolize a Trump who can get enough people behind him and maintain the radical nature of the party and even make the party feast on that radicalism and sustain itself on that radicalism. But I think in Europe, it's more a case of mellowing out. So I think we're going to see some real changes. I go back to Colin Powell's conversation with me in 1989. Larry, the war's over. Coal is gone. Mitterrand is gone. Thatcher's gone. Major is gone. They're all gone. They had their feet in the war. None of these new people will have their feet in the war. Well, they have their feet in Ukraine, so to speak, but that's ephemeral. It's going, as we just discussed. If Zelensky's got any sense, it'll go quicker rather than slower. Then what do they do after that? They no longer have that adhesive. They start breaking up. There's the danger. But each is probably going to go his own way, and they still have the EU as a chapeau. And if the EU would mellow out a little bit and quit being so Nazi-like itself and be more democratic, more liberally democratic, then Europe could have a very bright future. I mean, they already got a GDP that equals ours. They have a population of 740 million. Put Russia in there, you got almost a trillion. So the future for Europe could be fairly bright.
One of the members of Bundestag in Germany is talking about Poland and Romania using the NATO air defense system to attack targets in the western part of Ukraine. What's the strategy behind this type of thinking when they're talking this way?
The strategy is called STUPIDITY, stupidity. This is all politics. And if it were to happen, I think they get handed their rear end very, very quickly. But the prospect of escalation on the other side is always there. I mean, I think Putin is a calm, deliberate war wager, if you will. But there's only so much you can take until you teach someone a lesson. And I worry about that lesson being other than conventional. Bad development. I don't think Putin would make that mistake. He would threaten it, but I don't think he'd make that mistake. He'd figure out some other way to get back at the Poles, as it were. But I don't think they're going to do anything like that. I just, Poland would be the country I'd pick to be the most obdurate and the stupidest. But I don't think I'm right in that sense with respect to what you just said. I just don't think they're going to escalate this thing from Warsaw. Rhetoric, yes, but I don't think they're going to do it. And if they do, they'll get, as they have been so many times in the past, taught a very bitter lesson.